thoughts. Community radio is defunded, not defeated. But we need your help. In addition to supporting KFAI, we ask that you consider donating to AMPR's statewide effort to keep community radio on the dial. Donate generously online today at ampers.org.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. Dave Gutnick will be on there after a bit, and we'll have Dave Logsdon also talking about upcoming activities for Vets for Peace. But we want to start off with an article that I wrote, read in Dollars and Cents, which is a magazine that I, in my economic life, I distribute to co-ops and bookstores and the like. And I wanted to have a talk today about mass deportations drain economic growth. There is no trade-off. Immigration fuels the economy. It's in the Up Against the Wall Street Journal column by John Miller, who is a professor emeritus of economics at Wheaton College, and he's a member of the Dollars and Cents Collective. John, I hear some bings and bangs, but are you there with me?
I am here.
Oh, good.
I hope you can hear.
Yeah, now you're coming through just fine. And let's talk about Dollars and Cents first. It's congratulations. You just, September, October was the number 380. That's quite a bit. But the thing I like about Dollars and Cents is that it's you can understand the world in economic terms without having to go through Econ 1 and 2 with the supply-demand curves or let alone economics. So Dollars and Cents is a magazine, and you've been with it over 10 years.
No.
Why don't you talk about why you do it?
Yeah. I've been writing for Dollars and Cents since the summer of 1987. So that's a good bit more than, that's almost what, 4 decades now? 3 decades anyway. Well, and coming on 4. And, you know, it's Dollars and Cents is a 50-year-old West Wing progressive economics magazine. We're a political magazine, but we're not a regular political magazine because our assignment is to debunk what's going on in the economy, and our particular mission is to write in a way that's accessible to a wide audience. We don't ask people to draw supply and demand curves. We try to talk about what's going on in a language that most everybody could read, and in particular, will speak to the concerns of activists and arm them with arguments that they can use in their work. For about 20 years, I guess, I've been writing Up Against the Wall Street Journal, and that's the name of my column. And I think it sort of encapsulates what our mission is to take what the business press has to say, and then to look at it from a progressive lens, and to let people know how what's wrong with the arguments and what would be a more humane way to run an economy that serves most all of us instead of just the richest among us.
And just in case there's some confusion, dollars and cents, well, the sense is S-E-N-S-E, making sense of this world out there.
Yeah, and I would also say it's an economic miracle that we're still around. I mean, 50 years is a long time for a progressive magazine of any sort. And I know I've come home from finance meetings. I'm also the chair of the board. And I told my wife, I said, this time I don't think we're going to make it. But we've made it. And we're just, the many of us that have worked for years for the magazine dedicated to doing this kind of work. And, I mean, the last thing I would say, for someone trained in economics like myself, I think of it as an AA group where I've learned to to get rid of the kind of specialized language of economics and speak English and reach out to people who want to make positive change in the economy.
What I wanted to talk about especially is that this mass deportations that Trump wants actually does not help the economy. And in fact, you start your recent column, when even the Wall Street Journal editors tell you that mass deportations are bad for the economy, you can count on it. Not that you had any doubts. Why don't you go into what you were doing a takeoff there from the Wall Street Journal itself?
The journal editors used a recent study done by the Dallas Federal Reserve Board, and they reported on it fairly well. I mean, what it shows is that if you take the immigrant working population, which is 4.6% of the labor force, 3.4% of the population, but so many immigrants are in the labor force working and contributing to the economy, they're a much larger share. If you slow even the inflow of immigrants, let alone the poor people, it's going to have a negative effect on the economy. And the economic studies of that are unambiguous, that immigrants' contribution to the economy helps them first and foremost, but there's a surplus of in trillions of dollars of what they contribute to economic output. And I found it stunning that the Wall Street Journal would say, wow, these deportation plans of the Trump administration are going to damage the economy. We have to make sure that he doesn't go too far. But what the study actually says is any reduction in the historic level of immigration is going to damage the economy. That immigration on the scale we've had it and would continue to have it without reducing immigration or without deportation would add to economic growth without increasing inflation. So they're really, the Dallas Fed is reporting what the unambiguous economic evidence is, that it is the case that immigrant labor built this economy and they contributed to it mightily. And that's true whether or not you're talking about low-wage labor, middle-wage labor, or high-end, high-skilled immigrant labor.
Now, of course, Donald Trump says that we absolutely must get rid of these undocumented, even people who have been here 20 years, even if they, well, for a while there, he was saying, we'll get rid of the worst of the worst. But he wants to get rid of everybody who's here, even if they've become a vital part of the U.S. economy. And it's because then people who actually were born in the U.S. will be able to get a job. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, it's true that he's promised that. He promised on the campaign trail to deport 15 million immigrants, which would be basically, all undocumented immigrants, like all immigrant labor in the country at this point. What we know is that the effect of that would be really quite damaging on the economy. That's talk on the campaign trail, but should he ever carry that out on that sort of level, several organizations have done investigations that suggest that the economy would decline somewhere between 4.2% and 6.8%. Now, that's a severe recession. I mean, just to give you some sense of that, in the Great Recession, 2008-2009, the economy declined 4.4%. So potentially could be worse than that. If you look at what the effects would be on state and local government, their revenues would plummet. If you're worried already about Social Security, immigrant labor provides a much larger contribution to Social Security than what they'll ever withdraw or for many of them even be qualified to get in the form of benefits. So all of that would be catastrophic. And if you look across industry, about 1 in 7 of construction workers are immigrant workers. If you look at undocumented immigrant workers, if you look at painters, drywallers, roofers, it's about 1 in 4. About 1/5, 22% of the number of undocumented immigrants in the country work in people's homes and doing child care, taking care of the elderly, cleaning houses, and the like. So there was even one study done by the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a well-respected organization that found that a 10% increase in the number of immigrants with less than a college education, less than a high school education, increased the number of people over 65 that continue to stay in their home instead of living, being forced to live in a nursing home. So, these are workers that are absolutely vital to the economy.
They are vital to the economy, not just that they're often lower paid or introductory wages, but also that they are have a lot of skills that they bring from other countries, and they do the hard work that actually is the part of the bedrock growth of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I mean, that's true both in the contribution of the expansion of the labor force, the number of people working, and with respect to productivity, how much, you know, how effective the economy is in turning labor into output. 88%, you know, that's like one in nine, you know, 88%, that's eight out of nine of the additional workers in the labor force from 2019 to work in the business. The growth of the labor force, that's almost all of it. And if you look at the highest, you know, and that includes the construction workers and what people working in the company, or it includes, you know, restaurant workers, people doing middle income jobs, but it also includes high end people. 30% of patents in the United States are originated by immigrants, or and all of that contributes to the productivity of the economy. And the other thing that's wrong with what Donald Trump is saying, the economic evidence does not show that having immigrants has reduced the wages of citizens. Almost every study shows that in the aggregate, if you look across all native-born workers, their wages have gone up with immigration. There's probably some downward effect for workers without a high school degree, and even that's unit, and maybe for some very high-tech jobs, presence of more immigrant high-tech workers might have some downward effect. But for everybody else, and especially for workers high school degree to college, the effect is positive. And it's not because there are more workers, it's because those workers spend their money in the United States, and that creates jobs.
I'm speaking with John Miller, and I'm wondering, John, are you on speakerphone by any chance? You kind of break up occasionally. It's a little hard to hear, but it's...
I just moved it away. I got excited and moved my hands away from my mouth.
Okay. Good. Yeah, much better. And one of the things you brought up is the... something that people might not really understand, that a lot of these immigrants, they're paying Social Security taxes, state and local taxes, which they're never going to collect the benefits of, but are a great boon to the accounts of, say, Social Security and state and local economic coffers.
Oh, it's absolutely true. And it's not a small amount of money. In 2022, undocumented households paid $22.6 billion in Social Security or payroll taxes. And very few of them would ever be eligible for Social Security.
It was interesting that the American Immigration Council study,
yes,
quote, estimated that it deporting all 11 million undocumented immigrants who are in the country in 2022, of course, there's plus an another 2.3 that have crossed the U.S. southern border without legal immigrant status and were released, that if they were to get rid of them all, here's the headline, would cause the economy to crash.
That's exactly right. You know, one of the other things that I found out writing this article was when you're talking about deporting undocumented immigrants, you're talking about deporting seven times the amount of people that are in prison and jails in the United States. It's a large amount of people. It's a population also that's vital to the economy. It's a tremendous undertaking, and to spend $315 billion on it is cruel, tragic, and a terrible waste of money.
I don't hear much or enough in my point of view, my hearing about what the economic effect of all this is. And it's interesting that one of the columnists for the Minnesota Star Tribune, he said, "I'm a rock rib Republican, but we've got to have immigration." And it's, and that was good. And then just about a week and a half ago, one of the columnists for the Star Tribune, Ka Vang, she said, it was in a letter to Kristi Noem, who's the head of Department of
the Interior.
After her visit, she was in Minneapolis. "Here's the most important point. Immigrants and refugees don't just add color and culture. We," she is also an immigrant, "add capital. According to research by economist Bruce Corey at Concordia University in St. Paul, African immigrants in Minnesota collectively earn at least $1.6 billion a year and spent about $800 million annually in the Twin Cities economy. Statewide, immigrants contribute more than $22 billion to Minnesota's GDP. And in St. Paul alone, immigrant households hold nearly $1 billion in disposable income, while making up more than a third of the city's manufacturing workforce."
It's stunning. And even if you look at places that you wouldn't associate with immigrant labor, like Vermont, dairy farms in Vermont rely on undocumented workers to function. That's who their workforce is. And they've been severely hurt by the crackdown on importation. I mean, we know the meatpacking story, which is a centuries old story. But again, in Nebraska, the meatpacking companies aren't finding the workers they need because of deportation. And these are people that are willing to work in particularly bad conditions. I mean, working as a roofer is dangerous, and a high number of the immigrant workers, roofers, are underage on top of it.
In addition, in this column, they had a study of Mexican Americans in Minnesota, and they estimated that more than $4 billion in total income, giving them considerable buying power. And the community contributes $23 million a month in rental payments across Minnesota, which amounts to $276 million annual infusion into the rental markets in greater Minnesota and the metro area.
Yeah. If you allow me to use supply and demand.
Of course.
You know, I think people's initial sense of why immigrant labor would be bad for workers is you add more workers to the labor force, the supply of labor increases, and that serves for the drag down wages. That's the supply part. But you have to take into account exactly what that newspaper report is telling you. These people earn money, they spend money, they purchase items that have to be produced, so they increase the demand for labor. So it doesn't follow, even in supply and demand diagrams, that more immigrant labor would be pushing down the labor force. You have to take into account not only the effect of the additional workers on the supply of labor, but their spending on the demand for labor. And they and immigrant workers' savings rates are very low, so they're spending, you know, a very high percentage, if not all, of the money they earn. And that really is why there's a net, is one of the chief reasons there's a net positive effect on the economy, even beyond the income that those immigrants earn on the broader economy.
Okay. You've been studying this for a long time. Wall Street Journal says, don't do this. And you've been pointing out how it's a bad thing. Why the heck is Trump going at it with both barrels blazing, and he's going to build up places for holding 100,000 refugees in these new constructed jails or holding pens, and he says it can't be stopped, can't be stopped, can't be stopped. Why is he?
Yeah. I have a few ideas about it. When I think on a most basic level, he thinks it galvanizes white working class support for him. You know, these are people that, you know, who have been left behind in the economy. Today, the wages corrected for inflation of a non-supervisory worker are still lower than what they would have been in purchasing power in 1973. We know that the number of 30-year-olds that are better off than their parents is now less than half, while, you know, back in 1970, it was 92%. There's somebody to blame. If they add culture and color, as one of the reports said, that makes them an easy target. And I think racism is part of the answer. It's to Trump's political advantage. I think the more interesting question as to why does Trump do it, it's why hasn't the business community been more strident in speaking out against it. And, you know, Trump is delivering tax cuts to the wealthy, tax cuts for corporations. But he's also making clear by the kind of lawlessness of this process that regulations don't matter and labor law doesn't matter. And I think that gives employers yet more power in their places of employment, and in their factories, in their offices, and more power over workers, and gives them a suppressing wages and keeping profits up. That's about that. That's my current sense of why they're not objecting more. But I think they're beginning to do that because this just isn't sustainable. I saw a spoof online about that Trump had sent ICE workers to harvest vegetables. And it made so much sense to me. I believed it for about till I got to the end of the story. But it's that kind of shortage that's really going to be damaging to the economy. And he's not going to have ICE workers.
Yeah, the effect is, I don't know, I mean, a lot of businesses around here in the Twin Cities, I seem to notice that they're always searching for people to work, and that they're, for whatever reason, there seems to be a lot less traffic on the streets. And if we start to reach something like you were talking about, which could be a 4.2 hit to the economy like happened in 2008 and 2009, well, that was a pretty big bump. A lot of people lost their houses. I mean, it was a housing bubble, but it would not be a pleasant time. Well, so dollars and S-E-N-S-E, dollars and cents, and do you have a website that people can look it up and sometimes
just cents. If you search dollars, ampersand, you know, and sign, and cents, N-E-S-E, you will find us on the web, on the internet. We also now have a Substack, which you can get on our website called Left Hook Economics, in which we contribute to twice a week with shorter articles. I just finished one on Halloween inflation, the specter that's haunting Halloween. It's also available at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, who many of the contributors to our blog are employed there. So, you know, look us up. If people have comments about what we write, please write in. We'll respond to them in our magazine, or at least respond to you personally. And, we're trying to be a magazine that presents progressive ideas to a broad audience that's trying to bring about economic justice in the U.S. And we see ourselves as part of that movement, and we want to do whatever we can to affect people doing that vital work.
Well, John Miller, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Wheaton College, and a member of the Dollars and Cents, S-E-N-S-E Collective, and for being on the show today. And I will do my best to keep the magazine on the some newsstands around the Twin Cities, especially the co-ops. Thank you very much.
Well, really appreciate all your efforts.
Well, we're back here on Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson, and Dave Grunick is here, and Dave Logsdon is here, and talk to Dave Logsdon because November 11th, what's the real name for it, and what's the name that everybody else hears?
Yes, it used to be called Armistice Day for the longest time until 1954. And Armistice Day, as you recall, it was a day that was, I think it was started in the 30s, and it was about our day of remembrance, and remembering the fallen soldiers, but just the remembrance in it, how awful war is, and how awful war is. And so in 1954, there were some World War II veterans and a Southern congressman, I think he was from Mississippi or Alabama, and he introduced a change, saying that he wanted to change it to Veterans Day because Armistice Day was associated with World War I veterans, and the World War II veterans didn't feel included on Armistice Day, or something like that. That was the excuse. And subsequently, Armistice Day has turned into Veterans Day, and Veterans Day has turned into just the opposite of what the original intent was to remember the costs of war, the awful moral and economic costs of war. And now it turned into a glorification of war. Anthems, flags, shooting volleys. In fact, there's a school up on the north side that's going to be shooting volleys on November 11th. And it's the whole idea of it's perpetuating the myth of war is making us better and stronger.
That's Dave Logsdon, who is the president of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace, Chapter 27. And war seems to be not only is it good for the economy, but it's, so to speak, but also, how are you going to be approaching how to really honor it?
Okay, this started back in 1991, and Steve McCune and Wayne Whitman and a few of the people that were active in 1991 came up with the concept of bell ringing. So they ring the bells 11 times. They started doing it out at the Fort Snelling Cemetery out there, and they got kicked out of there. And so it started this annual ritual that we do, and we've done it all kinds of different places. And the concept of it is that we want to just have people think about Armistice Day. In fact, on 11-11-11, in 2011, Mayor Rybek called it, announced that Minneapolis was calling it Veterans/Armistice Day in Minneapolis. That was in 2011.
Good. Well,
and today, next week, on Tuesday, at 11 a.m., we'll be ringing the bells at Victory Memorial Drive, at the Victory Memorial huge monument they have for World War I. We have people who will be marching at 9:30 in the morning, who'll be marching from Dowling Avenue, which is about halfway between North Memorial Hospital and the memorial itself. So those people will be marching, getting there about 10:30. Tom LeBlanc, a.k.a. Strong Buffalo, Dakota Marine Corps veteran, combat veteran, who is going to perform poetry. He'll be backed by two indigenous guitar players. And then we'll have the program and talking about why we ring the bells. And exactly 11 a.m., we will ring the bells 11 times in remembrance of the horrific costs of war that keeps savaging our world today.
It's just not the people who are wounded and maimed, but it's the people who psychologically
absolutely
live with this. And that it continues on, and war can do untold damage to your psyche. I mean, there's the rates of suicide are jaw-dropping. And so anything which shows how people can get around that, their feelings of whatever leads them to not be able to live in the world anymore, we want to keep them going.
It's a pebble in the pond, Don. It's like the ripple effect of there's so many victims in war, not just the people that have died, the people who brought the war home with them and created a lot of domestic strife But anyway, so we'll be have the program at 10:30, and the Buffalo show will be that night, and the same performers, Strong Buffalo and the two indigenous performers, Scotty Clifford and the other guy's name, a very unusual name, something June. They'll be performing at the Buffalo show, which is at Bryant Lake Bowl at 7 o'clock, and get your tickets for that because they'll go fast. So
Bryant Lake Bowl, of course, is over on Lake Street.
It's actually if you go to Bryant and Lake, that's where it is.
That's where it is. Thank you very much, Dave Logsdon, for bringing us.
Thank you, Don, for having us on.
Now I want to bring Dave Gudnick, who has been a long-time peace and social justice activist. And we have, I think we want to talk first about one of our close comrades who has just died.
Yes, thanks, Don. And thanks, Dave. Mike Terrio was a very good friend of mine and of Don's, a comrade for years. I'm going to read a little from an obituary I co-wrote with his longtime partner, Gail Grobner. And although Don Olson is not mentioned in what I'm going to read, Don was one of the group of Minnesota 8, as is known to many of you, and so was Mike. So he's the oldest in a large family of siblings, and he lived on Cedar Avenue, South Minneapolis. He graduated South High School, went to the University of Minnesota, majoring in psychology. In the 1960s, Mike joined the anti-war and anti-draft activities that flourished in the Twin Cities. Through the Twin Cities Draft Information Center and on campus, he met many new friends and comrades. In early 1970, a group of protesters removed thousands of draft files from the county and state selective service offices in St. Paul, an action for which no one was ever arrested. In July of that same year, 1970, Mike and a group of others planned to raid 5 small-town draft offices in Minnesota and ended up raiding 4. They were caught in the act in 3 of those cities and became known as the Minnesota 8. Among them, Mike and Frank Kroenke were arrested in Little Falls and were later tried before Judge Philip Neville. 7 of that group were tried and convicted of federal crimes and sentenced to 5 years imprisonment or to indeterminate sentences. They served from 14 to 20 months in prison and were released in July 1973. At Sandstone Federal Correctional Institution in Minnesota, where I joined Mike and was a close companion of his and he of mine. Mike joined a lively fellowship of draft resistors, conscientious objectors, and draft raiders of 20 or more on any one date at Sandstone. His easygoing outward nature made forming friendships easy in a stressful environment. Always extremely fit, he enjoyed, while in prison, outdoor handball and running and basketball, both indoors and out. After prison, Mike began his years of picking tree fruit at harvest time in Washington and later in Southern California, often traveling by freight train. While picking apples in Washington's Yakima Valley, he met Gail Grobner, and their friendship grew into a partnership of 50 years. Mike also developed his longstanding practice of scavenging and salvaging food. He celebrated gardening at home for many years, digging up every square foot of the boulevard and much of the yard. Dumpster diving fit his reliance on a 3-speed bicycle and his frugal lifestyle, and it yielded lots of good food for family and friends. Playing tennis and horseshoes were other favorite pastimes. A gifted athlete, Mike had a defensive style that was hard to beat. He also put in steady work at North Country Co-op and then years of employment at the food co-op distributor in Minneapolis. Mike socked away most of his earnings in a few careful socially responsible investments. So here's the end of it. 10 or more years ago, Mike's friends began noticing his gradual memory loss and indications of dementia. He had to give up his beloved bicycling and dumpster diving and mostly stayed home in the pink house he and Gail owned, working Sudoku puzzles and listening to music channels. Beginning 5 years ago in late 2020, Mike was moved to memory care facilities. And we offer deep gratitude to the caregivers, nurses, and aides at Pillars of Prospect Park Care Center and at Benedictine Healthcare in Minneapolis, who provided kind and compassionate support throughout Mike's stay. So, as I said, longtime friend of Don's and mine, suffered a decline, unfortunately, for the last decade or so, but really an outstanding personality and was a friend to a great many people.
Mike and I were close in terms of many of our outlooks and growing up over the years. He was involved with, he was living in Dinkytown when there was a big Red Barn demonstrations trying to stop destructive change of Dinkytown in Minneapolis, and that he was a part of this draft board raid, and we were all close together. And he and I were closely involved in the whole anti-U.S., the official story about 9/11. And he, we both were so disappointed that so many left outlets, magazines and otherwise, never got around to dealing with it. So he turned to some of the right-wing outfits, and then he took to some of the other conspiracy theories that sometimes people slide into when they do it. I know Marjorie Taylor Greene did something like that, and maybe she's extricating herself from that. But so there was some of Mike's views were to the chagrin of his friends, but we were always friends and did things together over the years. And Dave, we used to play a heck of a lot of handball.
Yeah, Mike and I learned that game while in prison and played for years afterwards some of the more intense and almost ecstatic, if you know about the endorphin high from vigorous athletics. It was really great fun, and it was kind of a religion of the body. We were athletic and fit and played passionately and intensely. Mike was so competitive, I could only beat him about 1 out of 4 games on a good day. And he was similar in tennis. He drove people crazy with his defensive style. Just kept hitting it back to you until you made an error, an unforced error. So another friend said Mike had the most unique tennis playing style he'd ever seen. So, yeah, handball was a great great pastime during and after. And, you know, he bicycled everywhere. He was always extremely fit, had a fairly strict but somewhat eccentric diet, and always had interesting things to say. I want to make one more quick mention. If any of you ever heard of the Red Barn film made about the Red Barn protest, Mike has a nice moment interviewed in that film. If you ever get a chance to see it, still worth a little walk down memory lane about a 1970s protest.
Yeah, that was the one made by our local film.
Rubenstein's?
No, the old guy who died a couple years back.
Brevard?
No. Anyway, can't remember everything, but maybe it. So it was something that we. He's been declining, and you know, if you know somebody with dementia or Alzheimer's, which is part of that, it's a slow progression, and it's he was. When in the later years, he didn't really, you're not able to communicate well. So but he was so fit in his body that he lived for many years. But now he's gone, and we'll be having, we'll announce something about any a kind of a memorial service sometime in the future.
Yeah, it's actually Monday the 17th in the afternoon at Nokomis Manor Co-op. That's the big housing co-op at 50th and 35th, but you enter on 36th Avenue, the east side off 50th Street. Monday afternoon the 17th from 2 to 5. Monday the 17th, you're welcome. Bring yourself, bring a memory, bring a dish, bring a photograph, bring an anecdote, bring yourself.
Yeah, they have a kind of a community hall there, and it'll be right there, and people will be gathering and talking, and that's these 10 days now from now, the 17th. On Monday. Well, we've only got about 9 or 10 minutes left. Maybe I've got on tape, I got more than it would be covered there. I was going to have something on the history of Venezuela, but do you have something else, Dave, that you wanted to talk about, or should I try just play part of that tape?
Yeah, I think it's fine if you play part of that. Just want to add a quick half minute on Dollars and Cents. It's a really good publication. I like John's description of their purpose, basically empowering critics of the existing economy with facts and analysis. So it's for us lay people. And I loved his description of their group as a kind of AA, I can imagine, because they need mutual support to escape their conventional training they've endured. So I can imagine such a group in the AA style. They stand up and say, "My name is so-and-so, and I'm trained as an economist."
Yes. Well, here I recorded Max Blumenthal. He gave a recent history of Venezuela. He did this on Tuesday, and Max Blumenthal is the editor-in-chief of the Gray Zone, who's been a long time. He's had such a good accounts of things happening in Israel-Palestine.
Yeah, the Gray Zone is outstanding.
Been covering at the Gray Zone for years. I interviewed Nicolas Maduro in Caracas at a particular phase of the war on Venezuela, and it's moved through various phases, and that's kind of what I'm going to focus my remarks on. This war could be catastrophic. Libya-style assault and destabilization attempt in the Western Hemisphere could be absolutely catastrophic for Venezuela, for the continent of South America, for the U.S.-Mexico border, and we've seen how pressure on the border caused by migration waves, which are the result of successive U.S. coups, regime change attempts, sanctions wars, has pushed our politics to the hard right and propelled Donald Trump's election. You mentioned my book, The Management of Savagery. I mean, in that book, I think I demonstrated how the so-called war on terror also helped propel Donald Trump to power in 2016. His return to power, I think, was fueled heavily by the immigration crisis. And whatever you think about immigration policy, I think we all agree it's a crisis. And no one's talking about the reasons behind it. Venezuela, we all know, has the largest oil reserves in the Western Hemisphere. It has coltan, it has rare earth minerals, minerals that are needed like lithium for Elon Musk's batteries, his electric batteries. Most batteries will be electric, and most devices and vehicles will be powered by those batteries by 2030, 2040 at the latest. So the rush is on. And global capitalism is in crisis itself. There's a need for assets within the West. there is a competition with China in which we just saw Trump and Xi meet. And Trump, one of Trump's key objectives in that meeting was to get China to end export controls on rare earth minerals because the U.S. can't get the minerals it needs to wage this AI war that it's initiating with China and to advance its own economies. So they're in a real crisis, and attention is turned towards Venezuela, which has been a target ever since Hugo Chavez acquired power, first in 1998, then a coup attempt was staged by the same figures of the Venezuelan opposition that are now poised to ride U.S. tanks to power in Caracas. We're talking about Leopoldo López, who's been based in Spain. The Spanish government is heavily involved in these coup attempts. The former colonial master of Venezuela, his father's a right-wing legislator in Madrid. He is the mentor of the radical Venezuelan opposition that supports attacking Venezuela with the U.S. military and sanctions and destroying the country just so they can obtain power. He was the mentor of Juan Guaido. He was in Miraflores Palace with a group of coup plotters after Chavez was first removed in 2002, taken by holdovers of the old regime, the old Punto Fijo regime, to a military base. And the Venezuelan people marched on Miraflores Palace a day after a corporate CEO, frontman for multinational corporations, Pedro Carmona, was installed in power. And the New York Times celebrated Pedro Carmona as the new president of Venezuela and tried to normalize the coup on the front page, meet our new president. The Venezuelan people were not having it. They marched on Miraflores. They demanded Chavez's return. And he returned to power. What did he do? He nationalized PDVSA, which was the national oil company, removed the old management, which saw PDVSA as a vehicle for essentially exporting Venezuela's wealth to the north. And Chavez enacted a series of social programs, established workers' cooperatives, rural cooperatives, literacy programs, housing programs, reduced poverty by over 70% during those years when the U.S. was pinned down in the Bush administration, focused on trying to steal Iraq's oil. And the Venezuelan opposition, meanwhile, was training. They were raking in millions of dollars under the watch of figures like Leopoldo López and someone you're probably now familiar with, Maria.
I think we're going to have to return to Venezuela next week in the future because there's a lot more to say. And we don't want simply their oil, which fits in its heavy nature with our light oil, but we want to own their oil to get leverage. We need leverage in our banks and corporations.
Yes, that is part of the whole, all the ships, including the U.S. largest aircraft carrier. In yesterday's Star Tribune, Stephen Miles from the university, now retired, says the American Bar Association should be working against these extrajudicial killings of these boats that we've been just told are drug runners. And same thing is done about the military legal officer, the JAG officers. Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. And stay tuned for Global Beat with Doug Kane.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
In 1913, Lake Superior unleashed a ferocious tempest. Winds roared at speeds exceeding 90 miles an hour, creating waves that towered up to 35 feet high, swallowing any ship that dared to sail. Over the course of four devastating days, this colossal storm wreaked havoc, sinking a total of 19 ships on Lake Superior alone, claiming more than 250 lives. In Duluth, the heart of Minnesota's shoreline, the storm's impact was catastrophic. Roofs were torn from houses, streets were submerged under 10 feet of water, and railroad tracks were washed away. The toll on the fishing industry was equally severe. Over 50 fishing boats were lost, along with countless nets and traps, crippling a vital source.